Hello and welcome to Sip the Speech, the podcast for professionals in public finance. This week's episode will be focusing in on policing and criminal justice. First, we're joined by John Bloomer, Chief Finance Officer at Staffordshire Police. John will be giving us his take on policing during COVID-19 and his experience of securing a CFO position very early on in his career. And then later on in the show, we've got Matt Ford from the Centre for Crime and Justice Studies touching on his report from last year on trends in criminal justice spending. For now, over to John.
Hi, I'm Kate Latimer and I'm here with John Bloomer, Chief Financial Officer for Staffordshire Police. Would you mind starting by just telling us a little bit about yourself and your career to date?
Yeah, sure. Hi, Kate, and thanks for inviting me to just have a chat, really. Just about myself, so I've been working in the public sector since 2010, really straight out of university, graduated out of university and secured a role in the public sector first as a trainee accountant at Staffordshire County Council, where I qualified. Then progressed on to being a senior finance business partner there. Around 2015, I left to join Cornwall Council, really interesting organisation. Spent 2 years down in Cornwall, then returned to Staffordshire, spent a short time working for the NHS before moving to my current role as the Chief Finance Officer for Staffordshire Police. Joined Staffordshire Police in March 2018. Been here for 2.5 years now. I think it's fair to say we've moved along a lot in that time as an organisation, particularly financially. Gone from being, I think, financially challenged and stretched, as was the wider public sector. We've turned our financial position around and we start to make some quite significant investments in areas of operational need and demand, and also returned our organisation to some degree to being a strong financial place now. So overall, really proud of what the team's achieved here in the last 2 to 2.5 years.
Okay, great. Thank you. So you became a CFO quite early on in your career. So what would you say have been the main advantages as well as challenges of this?
I think in general, people tend to equate experience in the public sector with years served. My view, I'm really strong, clearly, I suppose, quite strongly about this, is it's actually what you've achieved in that time that matters. You can have 20 years experience in the same job in day in, day out. That does suit some people. We shouldn't confuse that as being experience. Yes, it's experience in one sense, but it's not experience in many of the facets. I fit squarely into what is called a millennial. I think that helps you bring a different viewpoint to what you do. Again, most senior teams are made up of people that are in there, come from a different generation. I think that gives you an insight, actually gives you a connection and brings something to that top team. Just in terms of challenges really around that, you're always going to be seen as being young and inexperienced. You're always going to get that challenge. It's easy for people to dismiss you. I think that's unfair. But it certainly is there. It's certainly there in quite a strong way at times. From my point of view, actually, I look back on when I graduated from university in 2010 with the graduate's job market. I fast forward 10 years and I see the same thing happening now with the graduate jobs market. My view on it is actually someone was good enough. I was lucky enough and someone was good enough to me to invest in me at a time of what was a difficult graduate jobs market. I think it's only right that as a public sector organisation, we look to do the same again. I think that's really, really quite key to what we do. So, and that's one of my main advantages. I understand that quite recently what people are going through. I think we all have a real strong role to play in that as finance professionals at this point in time.
Yeah, and I mean, as you say, there has been a cultural change where, before people would stay in the same job for 20, 30 years, and that was kind of the norm. And now I think there's much more sort of focus on the skills that you gain, because obviously people, now kind of jump around a little bit more. There isn't as much sort of job loyalty as there used to be.
No, I think you're fair there. And I think younger people, they're looking for much more of a rounded career. I think the public sector really does offer that as well. So you're involved in things that make a difference to people's lives in a positive way. That sense of public good, public service is something I think if CIFA brings in spades and buckets, absolutely something I think we should build on. I think young people increasingly are looking for that more holistic job. It's not just about financial reward. It's about how we feel about the work we do. And so actually the public sector, we should probably look to capitalise on. It's our modus operandi. It's what makes us different in the majority of cases. I think it's a real strong selling point for us to get good people in at the start of their careers as well.
Yeah, definitely. So what would you say have been the pivotal moments during your career, which you would say have kind of made you the person you are today?
Yeah, I think it's a really good question, actually. If I look at first pivotal moment I had in my career was actually the first person that there was the manager, that was my first manager actually, just imparted onto me the sense that, yeah, as much as anything taught me a lot of what I know about accounting. So clearly he's to blame for everything that's gone wrong thereafter. Just having a good sense of humour in the workplace, really, really important. And everything that comes from that, you know, really learned a lot from Alan in his time, really respect him for that. I kind of go further on. I really had an opportunity when I was a graduate trainee, actually. My boss left, he immigrated to Australia. I sort of stepped into the breach because nobody else there to complete some work for him, quite a high-profile piece of work. That gave me a lot of exposure early on, working way above what was expected of me in terms of pay grade, but actually really glad I stepped into the breach. I think it had been quite easy at the time, looking back at who I was as a person, just to shy away from it. Actually grabbing it with both hands and going for it was the right thing to do, even though it came with, you know, painfully long hours alongside studying. Absolutely the right thing to do. And that really propelled me, my career, but more, I suppose more importantly, my outlook on things, really. I've ended up where I have, probably because of that as much as anything. More recently, in my current role, coming into a distressed financial position, having to turn that around. We've successfully turned it around. You know, it's not just myself, real credit to the team, actually. They've really turned it around. We're now in a really strong position, being able to use our financial resource to make a real difference to what we do. Again, on that point for me, it's really, really important around building the team culture and ethos as well, and celebrating success. We do that really well now. You know, we have a high performing team, and we end up being nominated and shortlisted for a public finance award, which we're really keen on, just to celebrate our success wider as well on the back of that. And then increasingly, you look to the future. I think if you have one eye on the future around being a CFO, if you look at where technology is going, technology will replace, and it's already happening in some organisations, will replace a lot of the more unqualified finance roles. The role of a finance professional increasingly come about the value added, the business advisor, the business partnering side. Yes, the nuts and bolts are really, really important, but actually, if you look at the direction of a finance professional, it's going to increasingly move towards business partnering aspects and away from the transactional level. Now, you think probably 10, 15 years' time, I think the days of people having teams that, for instance, pay invoices, they won't be there. That's the march of technology coming, and that's something I think we need, as a profession, probably need to get our heads around a bit more. I actually reinforce what's really, really important to invest in people and skills, and we need to look after our people.
So, in your experience, what would you say is the kind of the current state of the police force as a whole?
I think policing's on the up as a sector. I think policing is getting really good at that early intervention piece. It's working, better with partners than my view is, having sat the other side of the fence, it has done previously. So that's a real positive. Again, that early intervention piece, working with partners to establish things. Actually, when the police end up picking things up, it's usually because something's failed. Success for us actually looks like early intervention works because levels of crime go down, demand goes down. Actually, for us, that means being brave as well and investing resources in the front end rather than in the more responsive services. Clearly, you always need responsive services. Clearly, throughout history, there's always been a criminal element that needs policing. So that will never disappear. And actually being brave and investing in the front end in prevention and early intervention is absolutely key. It's something policing is absolutely committed to. I think that's real positive. In terms of the current state of policing, it's interesting to me you talk about what policing has some issues with. I think fair to say is how do we look to further make moves on things like equality, diversity and inclusion. There's some real good work going on. I don't think is celebrated and shared as widely as it could be at times. But again, how do we look to expedite that and move faster on that? And it's really, really key for policing to be representative of the communities it serves. It's fundamentally different to the United States and other countries. And we're policed by consent in this country. Policing in the UK is democratic, is a democratic institution. I think that's something we should celebrate more. And again, if people have issues with policing, crime, they have an outlet through the democratic process, which is through police and crime commissioners or through elected mayors. People can make a difference to what goes on through the ballot box. That for me puts policing in from a legitimacy point of view in a far different place to what's in the other countries, and I pick on the United States here. And actually something I think that does get lost a bit from debate actually, but it is a real strength of policing in the UK in particular.
And obviously the COVID-19 pandemic at the moment has put strain on all public services and it's changed everyone's lives dramatically. How has the police force responded to this?
Just picking our own experience, been a 24/7 emergency service. We never shut down, we never stop. That brings a whole raft of issues for us actually around being COVID ready in the background. You know, credit to the teams involved in delivering that. They've done a cracking job, really. Just to have police respond, you see, again, to the previous question around legitimacy in issuing of fines, enforcing COVID regulations. Again, we have to see that in the UK with the model of policing by consent we have. And again, if you look at policing in the UK, probably the response to UK policing is subtly different to you've seen in other countries. You know, that's something that I think we should again celebrate in terms of what we do. In terms of what the future holds for the sector, technology driven, what I would say with that is that brings a challenge to policing, particularly around things, investment in those systems. There'll always be a live debate in policing, as there will in, you know, there is going on in local government around reform, reorganisation. At the moment, that's off the table. We're sticking with the current model of, you know, 44 police forces. I think what will change potentially is what is done at a local and national level. I see that evolving over time. You know, we've seen the National Crime Agency formed sort of around 8 years ago. We've seen increasingly taking a stronger role in policing at a national level. I think that will continue to go in that direction. I think you'll increasingly see forces working together as well. And actually, forces do work really well together in the background. That brings a whole host of benefits around investment, avoids duplication, improves consistency for the public. That said, you do not want to lose that local slant to policing. I think that's really, really important. I think the future as well is slightly, it will be uncertain at the moment. We talk about you know, the last quarter of 20% drop in economic output. If you kind of, you know, translate that through to that, could be a 20% drop in the government's tax take. What does that mean for a public service that's funded via taxation? Very, very interesting. I know the government's committed to no return to austerity with a national debt of 100% of GDP. I do think that's a challenge. Be interested to see how that comes through. You're also interested in me to see where policing sits in terms of the overall government priorities. So we know there's going to be 20,000 more police officers, but where does all this sit with a really uncertain financial future alongside greater demands from the NHS, you know, challenges in social care, significant investment into education? Where does policing sit on that priority list? Is the ability there to fund it? So that I think is a challenge. That said, actually, I think, again, the future is also bright. I look at the people coming through our organisation, you know, just joining the organisation. They've just got a different outlook on things. We haven't recruited really for 10 years as a sector. Now see quite significant recruitment. It gives us a real opportunity to bring new people in, bring new ways of working in, and better represent the communities we serve. So that's I think the future is actually quite positive around that as well. One of the things that makes me proud of where I work is seeing what these people do on a daily basis, the passion with how they do their job, the fact that they are selfless public servants, the fact that to some degree they put themselves at risk on our behalf on a daily basis, also the human side behind it.
Yeah.
But I think to operate around policing, people see a uniform, they see the word police, actually it's a human being, it's somebody that's absolutely committed to serving their community. So, yeah, for my end, let's just celebrate that a little bit as well. They really do embody the values of public service.
Thanks, John. Some really interesting reflections on age and the part it plays in the diversity and inclusion conversation. Next up, we have Matt Ford from the Centre for Crime and Justice Studies.
I'm Alison Kroll, and I'm here with Matt Ford. He's a research analyst at the Centre for Crime and Justice Studies. Thanks for joining us, Matt.
Thanks for having me, Alison.
Could we just start off by you telling us a bit about your organisation and the work that you do?
So the Centre for Crime and Justice Studies, based in London, we're an independent educational charity that advances public understanding of crime and criminal justice. So through diverse and inclusive and durable collaborations, we work to advance knowledge of crime and criminal justice, champion evidence and justice policy and practice, and to support good legislation.
It's been reported that coronavirus has created significant challenges for prisons in recent months. Just last year, your organization published a report about trends in the UK criminal justice system over the past decade. Do you think you could speak a bit on how the pandemic has impacted or changed the trends you were seeing?
Yeah, definitely. So we just talk a bit about that briefing. See, I wrote it last year. It's called Trends in Criminal Justice Spending, Staffing and Populations, 2008-09 to 2017-18. And it kind of does what it says on the tin. It's part of a larger programme of work called UK Justice Policy Review, which just assesses developments in the criminal justice systems of the separate jurisdictions of the United Kingdom, funded by the Hadley Trust. The briefing explored trends in key data about the criminal justice systems in each jurisdiction of the UK. And just in case your listeners aren't aware, there are separate criminal justice jurisdictions for England, Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland, rather than it just being one big unified criminal justice system. And the report covers the main criminal justice institutions of the police, courts, probation and prison. And the aim was just to provide reliable and accessible data on trends in such areas as criminal justice spending, staffing and the population subject to criminal justice sanctions. So it's not as comprehensive as the SIPFA's report. And it aims to be useful to policymakers, practitioners, researchers and anyone else with an interest in criminal justice in the UK. It just takes like a helicopter view of the footprint that criminal justice occupies in our society, which is a long-term interest of the centre. So to talk about kind of like how coronavirus has impacted some of the trends, lots of the data sources used in that report, they won't be updated for quite a while, and particularly the spending and staffing data. So I can't speak directly to them, but I did write an article a few months ago that was basically about changes to the prison population during the pandemic and what kind of COVID related factors might be impacting on that. So prison population statistics are released every week, so we could see in real time what was happening to that. And there were some very significant changes occurring in it. And then there's kind of little bits of piecemeal data that have been released, you know, in evidence of the Justice Committee and things like that. So we can start to get a picture of what might have impacted the change in the prison population. I think if I just kind of like, for any non-specialist listeners, just give a bit of kind of like on ontology about how the criminal justice process works and how it impacts the prison population, just so you can understand the different kind of like factors which impact changes in the prison population. So prison is an end point of an institutional process which starts at the point of an instance of law breaking which comes to the attention of the police, either by a police officer observing it happen, or what's more likely is someone reporting it to them. The police may then record it as a crime and investigate it. They may deal with it either through an out-of-court disposal like a fine, or arrest and charge the suspect. The suspect may then be prosecuted and the defendant may be remanded in custody awaiting trial. If that person is convicted in a court, they'll receive a sentence, and prison is the most serious sentence that you can get. But they also include things like community sentences and court-ordered fines. And there's various ways a prisoner is then released, but they're usually supervised by the probation service for a time afterwards. And if they breach any conditions they have for their release or commit a further offence, they can then be recalled to custody. So as you can see, there's this sort of underlying dynamism to the criminal justice process, which determines changes to the prison population. And it's also necessary to point out that there's wider social forces and processes which underlie the size and scope of the criminal justice system as well. So factors like material inequality impact the size of the criminal justice system. There's quite a lot of evidence around the impact of inequality on kinds of different things in different countries. So levels of violence as well. So if we get to kind of like how COVID has been impacting this prison population in England and Wales. So the prison population in England and Wales, notoriously, as you covered in your report, rose dramatically from the early 1990s. We went from about 40,000 people behind bars in 1993 to about 85,000 people in 2011-12. And it's fluctuated throughout the last decade between 83,000 and 85,000 people at any one point in time. But the pandemic has seen quite a significant drop in the prison population in a very short amount of time. So on the 6th of March this year, a few weeks before the lockdown was imposed in England and Wales, there were about 84,000 people in prison. By the 3rd of July, it was down to 79,500 people, and it's remained about that level since. So there's about 4,500 or 5% fewer prisoners now than there were at the start of the pandemic. And in terms of how that's come about, it was mainly caused by the flows into the system drying up, so not attempts to reduce the prison population through early release schemes, for example. And if we look at kind of like some of the things we know about some of the data we have on the flows in and out of prison, so if we look at the starting point of the criminal justice process, the police released some provisional figures which suggested that crime fell by about a quarter in the 4 weeks to the 10th of May 2020 compared to the same period the year before. So there's one in four fewer crimes being recorded then than there was in the previous year. And that makes sense, you know, if you're supposed to be locked down in your house, you're far less likely to be going out and, you know, breaking the law. So there's basically less of the raw material on which the criminal justice works was occurring during the lockdown period. And if we get into kind of like the court processes, there's about a period of about 4 weeks in March, April time when no magistrates' court trials were taking place. And for quite a while after that, there's been a reduced number of trials taking place. And that's due to the loss of capacity due to the social distancing measures. This limits how many people you can now have in a courtroom, for instance. And Crown Court jury trials were suspended for a much longer time. They were suspended for about 2 months. And the number of jury trials still going ahead in June was still very small. I think it's still a very much reduced capacity now. And that's causing a big backlog in the court system. If we look at some of the data that we actually have, which is sort of real-time management system information, so the statistics they produce just to kind of like take account of their own caseload, not like official statistics, they suggest that receipts of criminal cases to magistrates' courts fell by about a third in a month in March, April time. And receipts of criminal cases to Crown Courts fell by nearly two thirds. So they're pretty big decreases in the caseload in a very short amount of time. And so we can see that whilst the flows into prison have been reducing, I also expect that many releases will have continued because most prisoners are just automatically released halfway through their sentence. They don't have to be, apply to be released or anything. It's just you serve half your sentence and, you know, you're released. And it's important to say here that at the beginning of the pandemic, prisons were identified as major sites of transmission of COVID. You know, if you think about it, it's kind of lots of people crammed together in quite dirty and squalid conditions in buildings with very poor ventilation. So, you know, globally, they will recognise prisons as kind of like care homes, as these are potentially going to be major sites of COVID being transmitted. And that wouldn't just be in the prison because of the flows in and out. So you constantly have people, you know, going in to serve their sentence and being released afterwards, as well as staff, different visiting professionals going in and out all the time. They're also a vector for massive transmission to the community as well. In April, Public Health England and the Prison Service recommended that the prison population be reduced by about 15,000 people to be able to manage the pandemic safely. And the government did announce in early April that up to 4,000 prisoners could be released early to ease the population pressures in response to COVID. But so far, only 315 of that 4,000, potential 4,000, have been released as part of this. And that's not kind of like, you know, in other countries we've seen a much more extensive kind of programs of prison population reduction. So in some European states, including Northern Ireland, actually, they've just released far more people early in order to manage the prison population. But they've also done things like suspended short prison sentences or just entries to prison for a certain amount of time. They said, you know, no one's getting sent to prison for a month or whatever. In England and Wales, unfortunately, what they've relied on is just that decrease in the prison population due to the suspension of court activity and the building of 2,000 temporary prison cells. And these largely amount to just converted shipping containers. But this basically gives them very little wiggle room if there's another outbreak, which there probably will be. And also the prison population has to go up again sometime. You know, if you basically have a backlog of cases in the courts that need to come through, then, you know, it's not like you've changed anything in the flows in. So it's just building up there and eventually it has to flow through into the prison population. But also that kind of environment where, you know, you're locked in a converted shipping container for most of the day and, you know, you have very much restricted kind of like activities that you're able to do out of your cell, then that's going to cause things like mental health problems, self-harm, suicide, all the usual kind of bad effects of prison.
Okay, that's interesting. And also, even prior to coronavirus, there had been a dramatic deterioration in standards across prisons over the last decade. Could you explain more about the current state of prisons and why you think the standards have fallen so sharply in recent years, even before the pandemic?
Yeah, definitely. So conditions in prison are really, really dire at the moment. So there's, you know, self-harm and assaults continuing to rise and self-inflicted deaths remain at historically high levels. Prisons continue to be overcrowded. So lots of people are, you know, doubling up in cells designed for one person. They're dirty, I mean, disgustingly dirty, if you read inspection reports. And many of them are old and dilapidated. Reconviction rates as well for released prisoners are still very high. And access to health services tends to be more difficult than it is in the community. And many prisoners just locked in their cells most of the day. Drug use is very high. Although I read that prisons, you know, they weren't very nice places to be before the last decade either. I mean, and so they've always abjectly failed in their purported purpose of rehabilitating prisoners as well. And it really isn't a surprise. I mean, prisons are designed to punish and hurt you. You know, you're isolated from your family and friends and the rest of society. You're prevented from really having any purpose or fulfillment. And I think lockdown has probably given people a taste of what exactly that feels like. I mean, if I was there, I'd probably want to take drugs all the time and hurt myself or others, I would imagine, in that type of environment. But we also have to remember that prisons are filled with some of the most marginalised people in our society. They're disproportionately from poor backgrounds, have mental health and drug problems, have histories of abuse and neglect, were looked after as children, were homeless, are from Black and minority ethnic communities. So it's really no surprise that we see high levels of things like self-harm, because these people are already people who experience social problems most acutely, and then you're putting them in a really harmful and punishing environment. But things have got worse. You know, I have the data show that things have got worse over the last decade. In terms of why that might have happened, I think it's self-evident that such deep budget and staffing cuts have impacted that environment negatively. And what the government basically did was they cut everything else, but they didn't seriously commit to reducing the prison population in a significant way. I know at the start of the decade, there was a bit more of a commitment when Ken Clark was the Justice Secretary to have a more liberal approach to the prison population, accepted it was too high and that lots of people didn't need to be there. But unfortunately, there was a media and public backlash and he was replaced. And so what we got there was the continuing of the staffing and budget cuts, but not an equivalent decrease in the prison population. And like I say, we lock up far too many people unnecessarily anyway. Prison population doubled in 20 years. And half the people in prison are not actually there for violent offences. I mean, you could conceivably cut the prison population in half and it would have no impact on public safety. So the priority really should be about significantly reducing the prison population. But of course, whilst people are in prison, they are entitled to be treated with dignity and respect and in as humane conditions as possible. But I think as a priority, that should involve addressing the £900 million backlog of repairs in prisons, to which the government has so far only committed £156 million. And that's just to make them, you know, slightly more tolerable environments. It could involve something like, you know, a like-for-like replacement of old prisons with new ones. I think that's quite a dangerous strategy personally, just because the Prison Estate Transformation Programme was originally intended to do this. It's now transformed into something which is about adding prison capacity. And we should absolutely not be increasing capacity in the prison system or locking up any more people. And we have the highest rate of imprisonment in the whole of Western Europe. And in the longer term, we should be investing in proper solutions to harm and meeting people's needs that prisons and punishment are no longer required. And that includes basic things like providing enough good quality social housing all the way to preventive public health strategies to violence. They would be real kind of strategies to keeping us safe and free from harm.
So I want to go back to speaking about the report. Your report mentioned that all jurisdictions of the UK justice system have faced decreases in expenditure.
Yeah.
Over the past decade,
yeah.
SIPFA actually released a report at the end of last year called the Performance Tracker that was done in collaboration with the Institute for Government. Mm-hmm. And that report found that day-to-day spending on prisons fell by 21% in real terms between 2009 and 2016. Does this reflect your findings?
Yeah. I read the very interesting informative report that, like I said, is far more in depth than mine. Mine is a kind of like high level thing looking at the criminal justice system. And yeah, kind of, I mean, ours kind of broadly match what your report said, although the figures for mine for spending only cover 2012-13 to 2016-17. That's just kind of a quite boring technical point about because we were looking to compare between jurisdictions of the UK, you're quite limited in terms of the data that does that. So we used the HM Treasury public expenditure statistical analyses, which kind of like standardizes things, you know, it's accountants, so they standardize things so that you can compare across different jurisdictions. But it did mean we only have a 5-year trend basically to look at. But it did show that in England and Wales, prisons faced cuts of 7% over that period. But that masks the fact that between 2012-13 and 2014-15, there was a 15% decrease in prison expenditure in that jurisdiction. It's then gone up by about 10% in the 2 years following that, as they tried to recruit more prison officers and slightly improve conditions because of just how much they were deteriorating. But in terms of that time period, it was actually the police and the law courts which had the biggest cuts to expenditure of 10% each, looking over the whole 5-year period. And also I know that at the very start of the decade, there were very, very big cuts to prison spending as well. So the figures probably add up to about 21% if you looked at it all the way back. But I think there's also been that reduction in prison staffing, which has followed the cuts to expenditure as well. I think it's also important for a bit of perspective to understand that if you look further back, the criminal justice system received an explosion in spending during the 2000s under New Labour. I mean, quite sort of unprecedented, you know, increase in its kind of like size and scope, which included things like the increase in the prison population, but also massive increases to police budgets, massive explosive increases to police numbers, and then an increase in obviously in the number of people that were caught up in criminal justice. Yeah, that's kind of like a bit of perspective beyond that to realise that the reductions we've seen over the last decade were actually in the context of, you know, an explosion in the size and scope of criminal justice in the decades previously.
So the report also mentioned that there can be a correlation between an increased number of police officers and an increased number of people prosecuted and put in prison.
Yeah.
Do you foresee an increase in the prison population as a result of Operation Uplift?
So Operation Uplift is the massive recruitment drive of police officers. So I think Boris Johnson has said he wants to increase the number of police officers by 20,000 basically to restore them to the levels that they were at before 2010, before the cuts to police budgets and officer numbers began. Although I think that actually, because of obviously you have people leaving the force as well, that would, he needs to employ something like 46,000 new police officers in about 3 years or something. So it's quite a big job. And yeah, it definitely makes it more likely that you're going to see an increase in the prison population. And in fact, a representative of the government has actually said that in evidence to the Justice Committee. Because remember, I mean, police activity is the entry point to the criminal justice system. And if you give more people with the power of arrest and the power to prosecute people, then more people are going to arrest and prosecute. There's always enough law breaking to them to find to have enough work to do. But there's all kinds of other factors, you know, that also influence the size of the prison population. So if you start from the fact that most people who are arrested and prosecuted and sent to prison are young adults, so, you know, 16 to 25. The size of that population is, you know, ultimately is the thing which determines, you know, how many people are available to be sent to prison. But also there's economic factors and social factors. So we're seeing already massive levels of unemployment occurring because in the wake of the COVID virus, that would probably at least create more people who are likely to come into contact with criminal justice system and be arrested, prosecuted and sent to prison. So, yeah, there's all kind of, you know, there's what offences people are getting, you know, arrested for. That has an influence. So there's kind of like a web of different factors which interrelate and cause, you know, changes to the prison population. But certainly having more police officers, significantly more police officers, it definitely makes it more likely that you will see an increase in the prison population. And like I said, so this policy of increasing police officer numbers came about because obviously the coalition government and then the Conservative one which followed reduced the number of officers by about 20,000. And that was to levels seen in around the year 2000. But again, that followed massive expansion in police budgets and officer numbers under the Labour governments of the 2000s. And that actually saw policing creep into all kinds of areas of social life. And the end result of that was a caseload of which only 20% is crime related. There was, in 2014, there was a College of Policing report, which was attempting to measure exactly what work the police are doing, because they were obviously then their budgets were so restricted, they really need to think like, what do we need to focus on? So they attempted to understand what exactly it is, you know, that the police caseload is composed of. And in summary, it was kind of like only 20% is crime related. And lots of the other stuff is kind of, you know, is things like responding to public concerns for people's welfare. So, you know, someone's not answering when you're knocking on their door. Also things like mental health, you know, crises, people in mental health crises, they end up getting detained. And that is one of the reasons that, you know, I've no doubt these officers are massively overstretched, is because they're dealing with lots of stuff that really isn't their responsibility and shouldn't be their responsibility. So we need to basically significantly restrict the scope of policing work. So they're not the people who are dealing with things like missing persons, people in mental health crises, concerns for people's welfare and so on. And so with that reduced caseload, then they can refocus on those serious emerging complex crimes. And what we should instead do is employ more things like, you know, social workers, health professionals, people who are really qualified to deal with, you know, that social work type stuff that has basically become the responsibility of the police over the last few decades. And also, I just say people who commit non-violent offences probably shouldn't be sent to prison as well. I mean, that would help to stave off an increase in the prison population. And again, in the longer term, we should be looking at building alternative approaches to addressing harm, which are kind of like more preventive.
Great. Well, thanks for going through all of that with us. It was very informative. Thank you for joining us.
That's all right. Thanks for having me, Alison.
You've been listening to Sip for Speaks. That's about all we've got time for this week. Thanks again to both of our speakers for joining us in this special episode on policing and criminal justice. Some real food for thought there. If you'd like to submit suggestions for themes you'd like us to explore in Sip for Speaks, please do ping us an email on media@sipfor.org. Until next time.